Well, good evening, everybody. Nice response. Thanks for coming this evening. It's always a challenge at these annual events to condense a year's worth of news, a year's worth of markets, a year's worth of stress into an hour and a half program. And I was telling a colleague of mine the other day that I always assume that everybody pays attention to the news. So my job tonight is not to recite the news. You don't need me for that. But my job is to tell you, as a result of what you've read, as a result of what you've witnessed, what my take is on it, and to try to dispense the collective wisdom of our firm to individual investors. Certainly appreciate your business. I appreciate your attendance tonight. I know there are a lot of things on the entertainment calendar. Thank you for spending the evening with us. The first subdivision ever built in the United States was Levittown, out on Long Island. 1949 was the response to the U.S. troops coming back from the Second World War. I grew up in the second subdivision ever built in the country, Ridgewood Lawns. 456 Cape Cod houses, they were all exactly alike, built in 1950. My parents paid a little over $9,000 for their little Cape Cod house, a little bit more than average, because they wanted a garage. Growing up in the 50s, just outside New York City, one of the coolest things that we did was to be part of Boy Scouts. It was the most popular thing in my community. Every week, hundreds and hundreds of us would pour into the First Presbyterian Church in Ridgewood. And I loved it. And I did it all. I was a Cub Scout, a Weeblo, a Boy Scout, went to Explorers, ultimately Sea Explorers, won the Fire by Friction Award at the Jamboree. When I was in junior high school, I got the God and Country Award along with my twin brother. I'm still proud of that. So a guy named Robert Baden Powell started scouting. And as most of you know, he came up with this motto, be prepared. I was thinking about that motto the other day, getting ready for tonight, and realizing that all these years later, decades and decades later, I've incorporated that motto into my professional life. And I've incorporated that motto into the way I manage everybody's money here. Be prepared. I've spent thousands of hours sailing thousands of miles on the Great Lakes. Be prepared sure comes in handy there. I've got a dinghy, a lifeboat, life jackets, flares, emergency medical kits, backup satellite equipment, backup radios, backup computers. So I employ the same strategy when I manage money. Be prepared. You know, storms come. We all know that. The surprise shouldn't be that the storm comes. The surprise is if you're not ready for it. So I know as a manager that since 1975, the storms come on average every 4.5 years. Next one's not a matter of if, folks. It's coming. So the surprise is if you're not ready. The surprise is somehow if you think that the sky is going to clear, the clouds will part, the sun will come out, and it'll be sunny from here on out. Think of this. In the 8 major sell-offs since I started in 1975, nobody called 4 of them. How's that for comfort? Nobody called 4. 9/11, Persian Gulf crisis, the crash in 87, and the Arab embargo. Now, plenty of us called the other 4, but nobody called half of the major downturns in the last 36 years. So one of my goals tonight is to teach you folks, and for many of you, remind you of how to be prepared, of how to build balanced portfolios so no ifs, ands, doubts, or buts about it, you're ready. And the surprise isn't such a surprise when it comes. So my job, besides talking about balance, is to jump you all to the graduate school level. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about correlation theory. Pretty easy to explain, sounds complicated, very hard to implement. Going to talk about the economy, both here in the United States and overseas. And of course, I'll discuss the stock markets, the bond markets, both domestically and internationally. Paul Coldagelli, a senior vice president on our staff, will be talking after I speak about a strategic shift between dividends and interest. We think this is a big deal. Paul's also got a couple of other things he wants to share. So I normally like to start the descriptions of the economy talking about what I worry about, talk about what I really worry about, and then talk about hope. Okay? Talk about why I'm guardedly optimistic for the eventual outcomes for our economy and in the markets. But it's only fair that I start talking about what I worry about. Leading the list has to be the sovereign debt problems in Europe. At some point in time, we're going to decide as a country that we should kill off the big banks. And if they're too big to fail, it's not fair that they hurt us because of their recklessness. What happens with banks if they find out that we're going to keep bailing them out is they're going to take ever more risk. They have nothing to lose, right? They know that we're going to backstop them and we're going to bail them out. So don't let anybody ever tell you that we can't do away with the big banks. Very cynical when it comes to big banks. I laughed the other day when I saw UBS got taken for $2.3 billion by one of their employees. Strikes me as a big number. Who was watching? Wasn't anyone watching? Now they can dismiss that as they're a huge company, $2 billion, that's peanuts. They can dismiss that the client's money wasn't at risk. Strikes me as a big number. So one of the problems that I have with Europe is that the problems aren't really solvable. So picture Prime Minister George Papandreou. Now, if there was ever a guy between a rock and a hard spot, he's the guy. Suicide is up 40% in Greece in the last 12 months. Personal bankruptcies are skyrocketing. And it's not a solvable problem. One out of three people in Greece work for the government. And it's a democracy. So in a democracy, they're not going to vote themselves out of a job. So you have Papandreou on one hand, then you have Chancellor Angela Merkel on the other. Now she's quickly losing her political coalition to bailout Greece. And so they're deciding that they're just going to bail out their banks and let Greece go down. It's unfortunate for Greece. I spent two summers in Greece, loved it. Beautiful country, beautiful people. Really enjoyed my time there. But the essence of the problem is banks are not required to disclose collateralized debt obligations or derivatives on their books. So for those of you that like to play cards, if I think you're holding a bag of garbage, you really ought to let me peek, right? Because if you don't let me peek, I'm just going to assume you're holding a bag of garbage. And that's the essence of the problem in Europe. They don't want to disclose their collateralized debt obligations or their derivatives. And that's not a solvable problem with Greece. Can't solve it. They're going to default. And so what's got the markets on edge is an inevitable train wreck. We're just all trying to figure out when exactly is it going to play out. It's going to play out quickly in the next couple of weeks. But it's not a solvable problem. And we witness the lack of transparency, frankly, in my opinion, the lack of honesty amongst the people that run the big banks, the big multinationals. And I think that's a problem. Third on my list is lack of job creation. Now, in the story that I'll unwind this evening, I'm pretty pessimistic when it comes to the U.S., pretty optimistic when it comes to global growth. But one of the problems in the United States is we've got 16 million people that are either unemployed or underemployed. When we talk about the rising deficits, 37% of the increase in the deficit the last 2 years has come because of a collapse in tax receipts. A lot of people want to meow about spending. That's not what's causing it. It's a collapse in tax receipts. You want to bring the deficits down? Create jobs. People will pay income tax, and we'll bring the debt down. Now, the problem we saw last month, there wasn't a single job created in the United States privately. And yet the government continues to lay people off. So as a result, we've had very little net employment, 9.1%. We read the other day, one out of six people in the United States is below the poverty line. It was the biggest number in 54 years. Worse yet, A quarter of all children are in poverty. That's a disgrace. We have problems with housing, of course, negative feedback loop. You lose your job, you're less likely to hang on to your house. There's another house on the market, further depressing home prices. Hopefully the negative feedback loop on housing will come to the end this year or next year. And then last but not least of my depressing list is geopolitical risk. Wasn't it an amazing year? I mean, think of what they're now calling the Arab Springtime. Wow. Who would have thought? Egypt, now Libya, the rest of North Africa is about to go. So none of us know for sure what kind of government they're going to embrace. Hopefully it'll be what we do, democracy. So my list of worries, some of them are solvable. The employment situation in the U.S. probably isn't solvable for a while. Housing is probably not solvable, in my opinion, here in the United States. Lack of transparency, hopefully we'll elect leaders that realize that we need more rules, not fewer. You know, when it comes to rules, I think if what you do hurts you, hey, have at it. I don't care. But if what you do hurts me, then we're going to have to talk. And I think there ought to be rules that prevent you from hurting me. And so when the big banks cause the biggest financial collapse in 75 years, it seems to me somehow we ought to have rules to prevent those people from hurting us again. Fool me once, but not twice. So when we talk about economic growth, I think it's important to point out that by the end of this month, we're going to pass GDP where it was in 2007, just before the downturn. Pretty interesting, huh? We're finally getting back to where we were. Now, granted, it took the better part of 4 years. It was the longest recovery from a recession since the end of the Second World War. But the good news is we're coming back. You look at the projections on this slide, and this gives you a sense of the next couple of years. So you start in the middle of the chart, you can see how bad it got by 2009. GDP in real terms fell 3.5%. Last year, GDP rebounded to a positive 3%. And of course, what we're discussing here is the total value of goods and services produced in the United States. This year, we're on pace for about 1.6%, half of what the long-term average is. Next year, they think we're going to do about 2.2%, then venture a guess out to 2013, the number goes to 2.5%. On the top of the chart, we put what the 70-year average for growth has been in this country at 3.4%. To get an idea how significantly below trend line we are. Get a sense of employment since 1941. One of the reasons why we wanted to put this chart up on the screen was to give you a sense of how many jobs there were in the 50s. And look at that, about 50 million jobs. You go to the current time, we've got about 135 million working Americans. So in my adult, in my lifetime, I should say, jobs have gone up 2.5-fold. But you look at the last 10 years, been pretty tough. Look at the number of months down at the bottom right of the chart. How many months after recession to recover employment? Seems to me that it gets worse every time. Right, the last go around, after 9/11, that took over 3 years to recoup. I think it'll take the better part of 10 years to recoup the jobs that we've lost in the last 4 years. So I think I should quickly shift to why I'm hopeful before y'all walk out on me. So here's my favorite data point by far. 40% of the world is growing faster than 6% a year right now. 40% of the world. My wife and I met a guy named Charlie last month. Really got a kick out of this guy. Mid-70s, grew up in the Bronx. He was telling Kathy and I that for years and years and years and years, he only knew Irish people. He only knew Catholics. And he only knew Yankees fans. So, of course, from here, the first thing I thought of was, Charlie, you better be careful, the Brewers are coming. But I think of tunnel vision that folks have, this narrow view that we sometimes succumb to. And you can't blame Charlie. He lived in an Irish neighborhood. There were only Catholic churches, and there were only Yankees fans. And the reason why I bring up this guy, I really got a kick out of him, was that it's critically important not to be U.S.-centric in your view right now. Because if you are, you're going to be depressed. But if you look globally, frankly, things are going pretty good. And what's difficult for many to get their arms around is that it's the first recovery in U.S. history led by the emerging markets. We've never had another one like it, not even close. If you're fortunate enough to sell technology down in Brazil, you sell earth-moving equipment in China, business is good overseas. There are backlogs of orders. People that are fortunate enough to sell overseas are doing pretty well. Now, if you run an international company, you don't care if a sale was in India or Indiana. You don't care. As long as you didn't give the store away, a sale is a sale is a sale. Now, unfortunately, if you live in Indiana, you care that it wasn't in Indiana. As I'll get into when I talk about profits for the market, this last quarter was the most profitable for the 500 biggest companies in the United States in history. Think of that. I mean, the current record for total year earnings, $89, was set 4 years ago. So it took us a while to come back. But we've now passed that, and on an annualized basis, according to the consensus forecast from Bloomberg, we're going to hit $99.74, they think, by the end of the year. So what I'm telling you folks is that corporate America is doing good, right? And they're setting record profits. And about every time I bring this up, see, we all know people that are struggling financially. We all know people that are struggling to get a job, keep a job, find a job. People are trying to sell a house, buy a house, keep a house. Everybody knows the stories. And yet I'm standing in front of you tonight to say that corporate America is the most profitable it's ever been. And to get your arms around that, you need to drill into the global growth story. 40% of the world is growing faster than 6% a year right now. Strong earnings growth, in my opinion, is going to continue. Got the projections I'll get to when we talk about the stock market. So here's another data point that you ought to remember. The average age in Asia is 20. The average age in the United States is 39. Almost 40 years old. We have fewer and fewer worker bees taking care of more and more pensioners in the United States. The last 4 years, we had a banking crisis, a housing crisis, the job market fell apart. So compare and contrast that to what exists in Asia right now. They never had a housing crisis. They never had a banking crisis. They have governments and citizens with surpluses. And they have an ever-growing number of worker bees as a percentage much larger than folks that are in retirement. So the economists talk about structural headwinds and structural tailwinds. That's what it is. So Europe, Japan, they face the same problems that we have here in the United States. High debt, aging population, housing crises, banking crises. And in Asia, it's just the mirror opposite. Same thing in Latin America. I looked at a Wall Street Journal editorial from spring of 2009. Wall Street Journal said that if President Obama kept spending money, that inflation was going to skyrocket, and so would interest rates. There's two reasons why I'm bringing this up. Number one, it never happened. And number two, I think it's very important to get balanced news. Most of you in this room get your news from one source. Stop. Make your own decisions. Make your own opinions. When did people start getting economic news from politicians? I don't get that. So when you read the news, do a balanced approach like I do. I get up every morning and I read the Wall Street Journal, cover to cover. And then I read the New York Times, cover to cover, including the op-ed pieces. So I'm getting the sense from the right, I'm getting the sense from the left. And then I read the Journal Sentinel, mostly just for amusement, I guess. But I think it's important to get balanced news. And so y'all have your political leanings. I'm not suggesting you not have those. But force yourself to walk a mile in the other shoes. And then form your own opinions. Because the Wall Street Journal was flat wrong in their prediction. But you know what happened to me? For months, y'all came into my office and said, the Wall Street Journal thinks interest rates are going to do this, and inflation's going to do this, and Bob, aren't we going to get creamed? And oh my God. So think of Charlie. The Brewers are coming at them, right? Charlie's going to have a miserable October. Doesn't even know it yet. So you've all heard me preach for decades now that only two things cause stocks to go up or down. That's interest rates and earnings. We learned last month that the Federal Reserve has no intention of raising rates for 2 years. So that's nice. There's a warning shot across your bow that interest rates can't go up. And I want to spend just a minute talking about the multiplier effect. That's the reason why rates can't go up and inflation can't go up for a while. So I got a former banker in the room. Homer, you lend me $2 million, I'm a home builder. I go out and hire 15 workers, half of them buy trucks to get to work. The people that build the houses buy carpet, tile, appliances, and what have you. Historically, we multiply the effect of your loan to me fourfold. Right? That's been the history. Well, guess what? The multiplier is broken. Bankers will complain they can't find qualified borrowers. The bankers will complain that regulators are breathing down their necks. The borrowers will complain that the bankers won't call them back. But the fact is, the multiplier is broken. And until that changes, it doesn't matter about deficits, doesn't matter about debts. Frankly, it doesn't even matter right now about government spending. What matters is that multiplier, and it'll ultimately get fixed. But the bank business model is broken. 4 years ago, 5 years ago, oh, you have a pulse? Yeah, you qualify, right? Well, those days are gone. And at some point in time, the bankers will get their stride, they'll catch their breath, they'll figure out yet another business model, and the bankers will get back to lending money again. But until that changes, inflation can't go up, nor can interest rates. The economy is simply too weak. So the good news is, for me, the global growth story is not changing. You know, and how amazing is it that global growth is so new? Right? It started in 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down. It's only been going for 22 years. We're in our infancy. I had the privilege of going to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. I told this story a number of times. In the spring of 1999, when I was working for PBS at the time, and John Templeton was there. The Dow just passed 10,000. All the media types were filming from the floor of the exchange. And a reporter asked Templeton, what's your prediction for the next 100 years? And Templeton said, well, let me get the numbers straight. The Dow started the 20th century at 100. And it ended the century, give or take, at 10,000. So the way he did math, he said, that would put the Dow at 1 million the next 100 years, which would simply replicate the success of the Dow in the 20th century. Perhaps the more amazing statement that he made was when he said the developing world would experience, he thought, an eightfold increase in their standard of living in the next 100 years. Not so much that America was going backwards, is that the rest of the world is playing catch up. And that's the global growth story. And so far, Templeton's right. I've got the statistics that'll back that up. For the first 11 years of this century, global growth is showing that the developing world is dramatically increasing per capita income. And more importantly, corporate profits are benefiting. How's this for a graph? So this talks about corporate profits after tax adjusted in billions of dollars. So take a look at the middle of the chart. That's the 70s and 80s. What a difference. So corporate profits went up dramatically the last 30 years. You can see how volatile it got during the financial crisis and the rebound that we've experienced since then. Now look at the profits from overseas. When I first started managing money, 14% of the profits from the S&P came from outside the United States. The end of the second quarter was 57%. 57% of all the earnings for the S&P came from outside America. Look at 1971 as a guideline. Give or take, corporate profits back then were up were at $150 billion. And here's the point I'm trying to make. Since then, profits are up tenfold. How cool is it that stocks are up tenfold since then? That's how it works. Been telling everybody for years, profits go up, stocks go up, profits go down, stocks go down. But here we can chart 40 years of history for profits and show you a very close parallel between profits and stock prices. So the conclusion, folks, the developed countries, sluggish growth, high unemployment, debt, and deficit concerns. According to Bloomberg, the developed nations will grow about 2% a year, next 3 to 5 years. The emerging economy should grow at 6% plus a year, higher growth, rising levels of income and wealth. By 2030, as you can see on the chart, a significant majority of the global middle class will be from emerging markets. They estimate now that there are about 400 million people in the middle class around the world. They think that number is going to triple, mostly because of the developing world, between now and 2030. So go where the growth is. I love showing this chart every year. I think maybe next year I'll show you line by line on how it's grown the last 10 years. So look at the developed countries of the US, Germany, and Japan. GDP in the US, as I said, about 1.5%. Germany at 2.8%, Japan still going down. Now compare that to China, 9.5%, India, 7.7%. There's a third of the world right there. And Indonesia growing at 6.5%. I want to make sure that everybody's clear on what growth is composed of here in America. You've all heard the one number on the right-hand side that consumer spending is 71% of our economy. You know, I need to point out that retail sales year over year are up 7.2%. Nothing bad about that. So the problem is governments are cutting back. They're 19% of GDP. And businesses are sitting on their cash. Good news is corporate cash is at record levels now. Over $1 trillion. It's up 58% since the financial crisis began. And they're eventually going to have to spend it. So guys like me look at a concept called capacity utilization. Easy to explain. It's the amount of plant and equipment in use currently in the United States. So you can see in 2009, capacity utilization sank to below 70%. So the English translation of that is, if almost a third of your plant and equipment is sitting idle, the last thing you're going to do is invest in new plant and equipment. Economists can tell you that give or take at about 81% of capacity, bottlenecks are created. And at 81% of capacity, companies typically get forced to spend. And we're getting closer to that every day. So as of the end of last month, capacity utilization in America is at 77.4%. Here's the point, folks. That's up 10 percentage points in 2 years. Right? So the way I do math, that means in the next year or so, companies are going to have to start deploying the cash that they're sitting on. It's not like they need to borrow it. They're sitting on piles and piles of cash. A couple of notes about interest rates. I implore everyone to follow the 10-year Treasury yield. That's your canary in the coal mine. Politicians did their level best to convince everybody that we're doomed when it comes to debt. I personally follow big money. Follow the money. And the big money has been pouring into treasuries all year. We started this year with the 10-year treasury at 3.6%. It's now barely at 2%. So if big money around the planet was truly worried about not getting paid back by Uncle Sam, they wouldn't keep pouring money into treasuries. So follow the yield on the 10-year. Now get this, I put this on the chart. The 49-year average for the 10-year treasury is 6.7, and we're at 2. interest rates can't go up for the foreseeable future. Talk about inflation. A lot of people meowed about this one a couple of years ago. The government spending was not only going to bankrupt us, but it caused inflation to skyrocket. And of course, I'm quoting the core consumer prices, excluding food and energy. It's up 2% the last 12 months. And to be honest, it's going up a little bit. But 2% is nowhere close to the 53-year average of double that. So core inflation is half of what we've experienced for the last 53 years in the United States. So the takeaway here is I think interest rates are going to stay low because of the multiplier. I think inflation is going to stay low. The economy is too weak. And then projecting out, this comes from Bloomberg projections, continuation of low inflation. This is the core personal consumption expenditure price index. I know that's a mouthful. That's Alan Greenspan's favorite inflation measure. It's buried inside the GDP report, comes out every 90 days. And as you can see, core personal consumption expenditure, that's probably the most accurate measure of inflation, is hovering, give or take, at 1.5% to 1.75% out the next couple of years. That's clearly good news. So I say this every year. Here's one of my favorite charts. Brian Kilb and I at the firm did a study along with his colleague, Lindsay, of not only what our overall book of business looks like, more importantly to me, what the betas are, what the alphas are, and to get a sense of rates of return for the last 10 years. And I marvel at how we were able to produce returns of roughly 7% a year the last 10 years, and stocks basically lost ground. And it's not that I got clairvoyant 10 years ago. It's not that I correctly forecasted bonds would outproduce stocks. It's not. It's that I understood correlation theory. The English translation of correlation theory is, if you get whacked here, there should be something in your account that goes up to balance the risk. And it's because I understood correlation theory 10 years ago that kept me out of a lot of problems. And I'm real proud of the 7% return that, as a firm, collectively, we produced for clients. Here's one of the underpinnings of correlation theory. And I'll cut to the chase, because most of you have heard this repeatedly. You get a whole lot past 50% in stock, your risk line keeps going up, but your return line flattens out. Another way to tell you the same thing is, you're going to keep taking more risk, but you don't get paid for it. If I get jerked around, I want to get paid for the volatility. I want to get money. Right? And if I don't get paid, I'm going to go for safety. And one of the most amazing things about this chart is, to me, the common sense that's part of it. Getting back to be prepared. Getting back to cover your bases no matter what comes down. As of the end of August, our firm had 48% in stocks. And obviously the rest, 52% in bonds and cash. So give or take, we're 50-50. Look where the graph flattens out, just past 40% of stock. And this year, and because, you know, we go back a determined number of years, that if you dial it up from 80% of stocks to 100% of stocks, you actually made less money. That's rare. You don't normally see that on these charts. But it obviously shows you, it's not like you're going to get more money by having 70% of your money is stock. That's for the novices and the wirehouses, because of how they like to trade. So correlation theory is the relationship between asset classes and their market movements. And what that means is they study how assets move relative to one another. If they move in lockstep, they go up together, they go down together, they call it high correlation. They're highly correlated. If one asset class tends to go up and another one goes down, they tend to have a low correlation. This is the second year in a row I made the cover of the Wisconsin Society of CPA magazine, an article that got sent to every CPA in the state of Wisconsin in January. I talk about correlation theory. The last 25 years, we've had a relatively low correlation between stocks and bonds. That's why that chart that I just showed you works, right? That's why I was able to make 7% a year for y'all the last 10 years on average. Here's why I'm telling you this. Correlation theory is heavily dependent upon economic conditions. The last 25 years, we had relatively low inflation, relatively strong economic growth. that reduces correlation between stocks and bonds. But here's why I'm telling you this. In the future, not today, not tomorrow, not next year, but in the future, the only way the government's going to get out of their problem is to reflate. Because of that, we're going to see gradually rising inflation. Inflation's pretty low now, not hard to guess that it's going to gradually go up from here. And we're going to see gradually rising interest rates. And under changing economic conditions, that changes correlation theory. So in the future, I don't know that I'm going to be able to get away with what I got away with the last 10 years by balancing portfolios just between stocks and bonds. Now, this year, it's worked out great. Guy asked me the other day, Bob, when do you start worrying? And I said, well, you know, I worry a lot. But when I truly worry is when corporate profits are going down, they're going up right now. And I worry when correlation theory doesn't work. Right? So for a whole lot of you in the room, you're up maybe 0.5%, maybe 1% for the year, give or take. Market's still down quite a bit for the year. And what we made in bonds, we gave up in stocks. Had you been in all stocks, you'd be down 4 or 5% right now. And the good news is correlation theory works. Right? The bad news is we broke even for the year so far. But when I worry is when correlation theory breaks down. All goes back to being prepared. I want to make sure I have an answer for everything that comes. And I want to make sure that it's not just the known risk, but the unknown risk that I'll be ready for. Think 9/11, nobody called that. Think Persian Gulf crisis, nobody called that either. So there are plenty of things that are going to happen to us that we're not going to predict. So the true art and science of portfolio management is correlation theory. Now, let me tell you the punchline here. In the future, there are going to be three ways to reduce the risk in your account. And they're all non-traditional asset classes. And there is only three ways to do it. Treasury inflation-protected securities. Many in the room have that already. Real estate investment trusts. We're just starting to get our toe wet there. And commodities. A number of you in the room, particularly the larger accounts, have commodities exposure. So those are the only three ways. We spend a lot of energy trying to figure out how to reduce risk without sacrificing return. Every now and then we'll get lucky, figure out a way to reduce risk and increase return. It's harder than it sounds. And then various permeations of the same motif of being able to increase return without increasing risk. But what I want you to remember is that correlation theory works, but it's highly dependent upon economic conditions. And as economic conditions change, correlation theory will change, forcing us to increase exposure to TIPS, real estate investment trusts, and commodities. For those that want to go to the PhD level on what I just talked about, go to our website. We posted the article that I wrote for the Wisconsin Society of CPAs in January, and they're on Balance Magazine. It's on our website, landis.com. Talk a little bit about stocks. As I mentioned earlier, earnings are going to hit $99.74 for year end. That's a record. Fundamentals, in my opinion, are very encouraging. I was mentioning to a client just before the seminar started that for the first time in my career, the dividend yield on the market is higher than the 10-year treasury. I've never been able to say that. That's a startling statistic. Stocks are selling for 13 times this year's earnings. Historically, we know stocks normally trade for about 16 times earnings. So not only are profits going up, but I think we're laying the groundwork for a potential expansion of the multiples. Get used to volatility. August was one of the worst months that I've been through. Very, very volatile. Stocks going up, down 3, 4% every other day. That was unbelievable. Mark Amateas on my staff wrote an article we just posted on the website about high-frequency trading. A lot of this comes from the trading firms in New York, private equity guys, and the hedge funds. Good news is they are increasing liquidity in the markets. That's a good thing. When y'all need money and I'm 1-800, I got to sell something, you need a buyer on the other end of the phone or the computer. And the high-frequency traders will afford increased liquidity in the markets, no question about that. But the bad news is they're increasing volatility, and I think we all need to just tighten the seatbelt just a little bit more. And not to totally beat this point to death, but the last bullet point favor multinationals to do significant business in the developing world. I love reminding people that when I started in 1975, the Dow was at 577. Think of that. I'm only 59 years old. So I show this chart for just one reason. We sure have come a long way. And then look how bumpy the last 10 years have been. Wow. Some of you may have seen an article in the Wall Street Journal the other day. Professor Richard Sila from the Stern School of Business, New York University, came out with a study. And this guy studies patterns in markets, and he goes back hundreds of years. This is an attempt to abbreviate some of those patterns. And I'm not at all predicting that the market's going to do well the next 10 years. I think it'll do pretty well. But if you look at the 10-year periods after stocks have done poorly, so the last four times it's happened, stocks have done great the next 10 years. So the four worst bear markets were shown here back to the 30s. The 10-year periods after those 10-year periods of bad markets, stocks tend to do great. So here's the earnings forecast. As I mentioned, $99.74, that's going to be a record. We're seeing impressive revenue growth, profit growth, sales growth. Companies are sitting on piles of cash. So profits are supposed to go up 17.9% this year. That's a lot. But at some point in time, stock prices will catch up with that. Profits are supposed to go up 12% next year and 10.5%, a little bit hard guessing the year after next, but they're expecting profits still in the double digits, and at some point in time, stock prices will catch up. So we all know stocks trade in a multiple of earnings. Historically, we're willing to pay $16 for a dollar of earnings. The 30-year average for the PE for the S&P is 18, currently at 13 times trailing earnings. Get this, stocks are trading now for just 11 times next year's anticipated earnings. That's a bargain. I rarely get to tell you that stocks are that inexpensive. Now, they could stay inexpensive. They could become a better bargain. But stocks historically are trading at rather low multiples. Comparative yields, you get an earnings yield. This is, of course, just the reciprocal of the price-earnings ratio. Earnings yield on the market right now is almost 8%. Dividend yield is 2.1, the 10-year treasury is 2. So here's the part I want you to remember. 7's a bigger number than 2. And as long as 7 remains bigger than 2, we'll get underlying fundamental support for stock prices. We look at this, gets updated every 90 days. This is courtesy of JP Morgan. Look at average PEs for the 9 styles according to Morningstar. Then we look at current PEs as a percentage of the 20-year average. You can see clearly that small cap stocks are expensive. You can see that large cap growth is a bargain. For all the money I've made myself and for clients over the years, try to get a bargain on what you buy. It's hard to look stupid later. It's when you chase performance that you normally get hurt. A lot of people, when they pick investments, oh, honey, this did good, let's send them money. And all you're doing is marching yourself over the cliff. You want to have the courage of your convictions to buy things after they've been hurt. So as you can see, the large cap stocks are very reasonable compared to the small caps. And furthermore, large caps dovetail perfectly into the global story. Little guys typically don't export. Some of them do. Most of them don't. So I think the balance is going to be switching. And most of you have money with us, primarily in the large caps. And we have some small cap representation, but it's getting lighter every day. So this is the VIX index down in Chicago. I mentioned earlier what's causing higher volatility. And I think we just have to get used to it. You know, one of the comments that I'll make about volatility is our average client has half stocks, half bonds, give or take. I rarely endorse withdrawal strategies for those of you that are in retirement exceeding 5%. So if you stare at that long enough, you know that if things go into hell in a handbasket I've got enough money, not even counting interest, to take care of you for 10 years. So quit acting like you need your stock money tomorrow. There's a client of mine in the audience, and I'm not going to mention his last name, but his first name is Dean. I love this story. He called me during the financial crisis. He hadn't looked at his statement in months and months and months. And he was deer hunting, and he was in the stand. And he pulled out his cell phone and actually got through to me. I said, Dean, don't force me to tell you. Don't, really. You're having a good time. And he prevailed. He told me, and he, God, you shouldn't have told me, Bob. And the reason why I bring this up is, and he's a smart investor, some people need to get additional tools in their tool chest to help them get through volatility. And one of mine is, and I watch stuff hourly, but some of you may not want to look at your accounts as often as daily, right? And the behavioral psychologists will tell you why. Is because there are more units of pain when you lose money than units of pleasure when you make money. And stocks go down one out of every 4 days on average. And you're going to be so miserable that one day you looked that you're not going to make up for it the other 3 days when the market does good. Now, legally, I'm supposed to encourage you to read your statements, blah, blah, blah. But what my friend Dean did was very effective up until the end. He shouldn't have called me then. I was hoping he wouldn't fall out of the tree stand. One of my biggest clients routinely will not look at his stuff when the markets go down. He said, what am I going to make myself miserable for? But getting back to the stock bond mix, for those of you that are in full-blown retirement mode and you're taking your 5% out, you're not going to need your stocks, if I include interest, for probably 13 years. And for those of you that are approaching your mid-70s and beyond, folks, we're talking about money you're probably never going to need. And I don't want to be cavalier about your stocks and be dismissive even, but it's important to put it in perspective. And I think by recognizing the balanced approach will help you get over this, because I can't do anything about volatility. But what I can do is put it in the proper perspective for everybody here. Before I introduce Paul, I want to just quickly talk about the fixed income markets. He's also going to be discussing bonds. The gist of the bond market is we're having a good year. Municipals are up over 7%. Corporates are up 4.5%, 5%. Bonds are doing good. And this is after everybody was saying that interest rates are going to go up, inflation is going to go up. I held my ground because I understood the multiplier effect. I knew rates weren't going to go up. So I thank my lucky stars that I didn't listen to the common wisdom. Be careful in a low coupon environment. So the math is simple. You multiply the interest rate increase times the duration of your bonds, and that'll explain price movement. As a firm, we're at 4.5 years of duration. Now, that doesn't mean all of you are, but most of you are. You want shorter durations. Interest rates are eventually going to go up. But in a low coupon environment, there's no coupon to absorb the hit to the net asset value. I think we're going to have to be careful here the next couple of years, and frankly, even gut out, even lower rate environment, getting ready for the inevitable. Diversify internationally. We've put a fair amount of your money overseas. We've done well with that. So diversify not only with sovereign debt overseas, but with corporates. Recognize that the developing markets, for the most part, have surpluses, not deficits. They have the ability to pay you back now. 10, 15 years ago, they didn't. And then finally, municipals offer good value. I want to bring up Lord Robert Baden-Powell again. He was the guy that came up with that motto, be prepared. Baden-Powell wasn't thinking just of being ready for emergencies. His idea was that all scouts should prepare themselves to become productive citizens and to give happiness to other people. He wanted each scout to be ready in mind and body for any struggles and to meet with a strong heart whatever challenges might lie ahead. Be prepared for life, to live happily and without regret, knowing that you've done your best. That's what the scout motto means. I want to introduce Paul Coldagelli at this time. Paul's going to talk about a strategic shift that we see between dividends and interest. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Bob, and certainly a very hearty welcome and thank you to all of you. And just want to thank you not only for coming out this morning, but certainly thank you for your loyalty to us as our clients, for some of you over many, many years. I want to talk to you this morning about a subject that I think is really quite important and that we tend to forget about. And if I'm successful this morning, I'm going to help you keep your focus on the right things as an investor. I have the privilege of serving on the board of a church camp in northern Michigan. And every summer, we bring a whole bunch of little kids to the camp. But before that, we hire teenage counselors. And we do a pretty good job of screening them. But we're very mindful that, you know, there's a lot of kids that come just want to invest their lives into the hearts of these little kids. But some teenagers, we realize, get distracted with people of the opposite sex. And so a couple summers ago, I made my traditional midsummer visit to the camp and just to check in on how things are going. And I spoke with the director's wife, and I said, "How are things going?" And she said, "We've had a great summer, except we had to send two of our counselors home." And I looked at her, and in all seriousness, she looked at me and she said, "They lost their focus. They were looking at each other, and they weren't paying attention to the campers." And in the wisdom of our camp director, they were sent home. And what we want for you as your investment advisors is we don't want you to give up and to lose the benefits of being an investor by looking at the wrong things. And one of the things that I really want you to pay attention to is why you own stocks, and in particular, why you own that category of stocks that Bob refers to over and over again, these large, multinational, many times dividend-generating stocks. Because this is a wonderful time to be a stock dividend investor. In your handouts, we've given you charts of four companies, four household names, if you will, of companies whose, if you look at the line, the jagged line, whether it's ExxonMobil, McDonald's, Procter & Gamble, or even Intel, if you look at that jagged line, you'll say, "Wow, that's a lot of volatility." But even with Intel, and I'll use them as an example of a company whose stock price has not done very well. But if you look at that stair-step part of the graph, what you won't see is volatility. What you will see is a fairly consistent and steady increase in the amount of dividends per share that these companies are paying to their shareholders. And we find it quite amazing that in the midst of 9/11 and in the midst of the financial crisis, and in the midst of all the events that have taken place around the world in the last 10 years, every one of these companies, and these are just examples, every one of these companies has committed itself to paying their shareholders a dividend and to giving them a raise virtually every quarter. Now, back in the financial crisis, some of the banks had to cut back their dividends in order to receive the TARP money. But generally speaking, the history of dividends, unlike the history of stock prices, the history of dividends is consistently up. If I had offered you 10 years ago an opportunity to participate in an investment that I told you, because of some foresight that I had, would triple your income over the next 10 years, most of you would have said, "Yes, I would like that. That sounds very attractive to me." And this being Milwaukee, you would ask me, "What's it cost?" And I wouldn't have given you a price tag in terms of a number, but I would have given you a price tag in terms of the emotional and mental discipline you would need to have to hang on to that investment. to stay focused on the income production of the investment rather than the ups and downs of the stock price. Because that really is what dividends cost you, is the necessity to commit to hanging on to the stocks that pay those dividends in order to continue to receive that wonderful dividend payment and that wonderful increase of dividends that we've demonstrated for you, and that we could go back 30 years. Quite frankly, we could go back as far as Bob went back on his charts, back to the 20s. And so we're inviting you this morning to think differently about risk. And the best way to do that is to show you what's happening to the income from things that most people consider safe, bonds and treasuries in particular. Wonderful investments, good to have in your portfolio, but they are not going to do the job in producing income that they have done in the past. As you can see from the chart, Bob showed the 10-year treasury earlier. This is the 5-year treasury, which is kind of where most of our bond portfolios are in that 4 to 5 year duration. The interest generated by those bonds continues to fall. And the interest generated by the funds that hold those bonds will continue to fall as older bonds mature and of necessity must be replaced by newer bonds which have lower interest rates associated with them. And as Bob mentioned, this is one of the few times in history that the income production from stocks is greater than the income production from the Treasury. Doesn't happen very often. And what it tells you is simply that stock prices have come down enough, dividends have gone up enough, that the dividends we receive as shareholders from our investment in stock, because we can buy dividends less expensively now, the dividends represent a pretty good bargain, and not only do you have a better yield today, but the prospect of a better yield in the future if those companies, as we believe they will, continue to raise their dividend payments to their shareholders. And so that's what we mean by the dividend yield, is what amount of income can we expect to receive from a dollar invested? Bob talked about the earnings yield. The earnings yield is even higher. But what we actually receive quarter after quarter is a dividend payment from good dividend-paying stocks. In the chart, in the picture on the screen in front of you, is an invitation to think differently. And I've deliberately put the word price fluctuation in fine print in your mind. Because I want you to stay focused, and I want you to think first and foremost of your stocks, not as things that go up and down all the time. Because when you read the newspaper, when you look at the computer, when you watch the evening news, they don't report to you very much at all on which companies increased their dividends today. What they report to you is the market was up 100 points, the market was down 300 points, whatever it is. It's price fluctuation. That needs to be for you mentally in the fine print of your mind. And think instead, in the forefront of your mind, of the income that you're getting from those stocks. And I want you to think, too, that most of you, because you're here during the daytime hours, most of you are retired. But I want you to think back to the day when you were at work. And your job, when you first took it, was something that you hoped, despite the inevitability of good days and bad days, good managers and bad managers, coworkers who were tough to get along with and coworkers who you were delighted to get along with, over time you thought in terms of a career. You thought in terms of hanging in there, staying with it, and the likelihood that the company would reward you with a rising paycheck every year. And as a shareholder, that's how I want you to think. Good days, bad days, good years, bad years, good decades, bad decades, but the very likely scenario of a rising paycheck year after year if you stick with it. Now, the benefit of investing as we do through mutual funds, diversified portfolios, is that it's not like working for one company. You're actually investing in a what I would call a consortium of companies, many great companies, and able to benefit from all of them, yet if something happens to one of them, you're not wiped out. When something happens to General Motors, and you're an employee of General Motors, you might lose your job. When something happens to ExxonMobil or BP because of an oil spill, you got a whole bunch of other companies diversified around them to keep you going. And so it's actually better than a job deriving income from dividend-paying stocks. Some of you, not many, to your credit, not many, but some of you, when the market comes down, are tempted to ask us, should we get out? And I want to suggest to you that that question is like coming home from work after you've had a really rough day, or maybe you've had a really rough quarter, and you say to your spouse, I think I'm going to quit. And your spouse says, well, what are you going to do? You say, I don't know. I just want to spend a few months thinking about it. A few months pass, you don't have your paycheck, and finally you decide, you know, what I had wasn't so bad, I'm going back. And you knock on the door of your former employer, and they offer you your job back, but at lower pay. And you say, well, that would really be stupid. But essentially, people who get out of the market are like people who get out, they don't know what they're going to do, they just don't want to be in it, and then decide to get back in when prices are higher. Essentially, you're getting back in because it now costs you more to buy those dividends. You're getting back in at lower pay. And so be very, very careful next time you're tempted because you see the value of your stocks go down. Remember, wait a minute. This is my income. This is my job. I'm not going to be too quick just to quit because we're having a bad period, because things don't look so good right now. I mean, quite frankly, as a father of teenagers, okay, my teenagers have bad days, okay? I don't give up on them, okay? Generally speaking, what I know is this. For them and for me, it's going to get better, okay? And so just remember that, as Bob suggested, we're going to have to put up with the volatility. Keep that in the fine print of your mind and continue to remember that the income, I believe, is really why we're investors, because the income long-term is going to enable you to do the things you want to do with your money, not just watch it go up and down, but to actually use it for something meaningful. One of the enemies of the investor is certainly worry, okay? And I wanted to share with you a thought. And the more I've thought about this myself, the more I realize it's personal truth in my own life. But the individual who penned this said, anxiety is a thin stream of fear trickling through the mind. And think about that. Worries tend to come to us, and left alone, it's just a thin stream. But he goes on to finish the thought, if encouraged, it cuts a channel into which all our thoughts are drained. And I thought, wow, what wisdom in that. And if you are encouraging anxiety by feeding it, by trying to confirm the reasons that you're worried and listening to people who want you to feed at their anxiety troughs every morning, that little stream is going to become an erosion in your mind, and it's going to start taking away all the things of good thinking and drain your mind of the way you should be thinking and instead think anxious thoughts rather than correct thoughts. So be very, very mindful of the dangers of anxiety. And one of the things I'll share with you is the scientists tell us when they study what people worry about, almost half the stuff we worry about is absolutely useless worry. 40% of the stuff we worry about are things that will never happen. 30% is worrying about the past, the second thoughts over what happened, what you could have done differently. Well, the intelligent person realizes that the past can't be changed. Why dwell on it? Why worry about it? Why beat yourself up over it? Instead, learn from it. And what I believe most of you have learned from the last 3 years is that it didn't make sense to get out when the market goes down. It didn't make sense to go out when there was fear in the world. And I want to really congratulate those of you who stuck with it because you saw your portfolios recover. 12%, we worry about what people are saying about us, most of which isn't being said with truth anyway. And then 10%, we worry about our health, which of course compounds itself, giving us worse health. And only 8% is legitimate worry. So I would invite you to think about what you're worried about, to think about the things that are bringing anxiety into your mind, and ask yourself, and take benefit of friends and your spouse and your kids and your loved one, should I really be worried about this? And my guess is if you turn off the media and the things that are feeding the anxiety in your mind, you'll walk away and say, you know, I'm not worried. You'll walk away with hope. Some of you wish that we had a real bright outlook. Some of you perhaps are hoping, although not realistically, that Bob was going to say things look great for stocks. This is the best time in my 34 years of investing that I have never felt more bullish about stocks. You were hoping Bob would say that today. Instead, you heard him give a very balanced approach. And Warren Buffett reminds us that if we're ever in a position where we all feel so great about the market, there's probably not a lot of opportunity in the market because all that optimism will be priced in. Wasn't that true of real estate several years ago? Wasn't that true of tech stocks about 12 years ago? And so a cheery consensus, which some of you secretly wish we had, would actually not be good for you as investors. We've put Buffett's words in a backdrop of two identical pictures, about 4 months apart, the planting and the harvesting. When the farmer plants, really doesn't know what kind of crop he's going to get. He plants anyway. And if the farmer was waiting for something that we would call certainty, he'd never plant. You don't know what the weather is. You don't know what the competition is going to be. You don't know what the worldwide markets are. But you go out every springtime and you plant. And so we would encourage you to continue in the midst of the uncertainty because, quite frankly, something good might happen. And isn't that a wonderful thought? I want to leave you with this final thought. I know many of you are discouraged. We hear all the time that you're discouraged with the governmental process in Washington, the approval ratings of politicians nationwide are quite low on both sides of the aisle. And it's real easy to get discouraged. And I wanted to share with you the thought and the picture of this Chinese proverb. It's better to light a candle, to light one candle, than to curse the darkness. In other words, find ways to care for others, and surround yourself with people who make you feel cared for. And it is our hope that you feel cared for by the people of Landis & Company. And I want to thank you very, very much for giving us that opportunity to care for you and to help you in any ways we can.
You know, I sure appreciate everybody coming tonight. We're going to stick around to answer questions one-on-one. Thank you for coming. Please turn in the questionnaires, and I appreciate your attendance. Thank you, everybody.